Hello and welcome to this special podcast episode. Special because we're recording it during UK FinTech Week, a week showcasing innovation in financial services on a global stage. And for this special episode, we have a special guest. I'm pleased to have David Tracy, Head of Data Science at Smart Data Foundry. Thank you for being with us, David.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Could you say a few words of intro to Smart Data Foundry for those who still don't know the company and your work there?
Sure. So we're a spin-out from the University of Edinburgh. We're a data innovation organisation. Our main purpose is to serve the public, private and third sector and to inspire financial innovation. I guess we were set up really to help improve people's lives by unlocking the power of financial data. We do that through our missions, which are to, I guess, help with the kind of the cost of living crisis just now and the cost of trading crisis for businesses, to help fintechs and other organisations to innovate, and thirdly, to try and use financial data to make a difference for the environment. So how can, you know, thinking about questions like how can banking data or other kind of financial data really help us to measure and hopefully make a positive impact on the climate crisis, which is ongoing just now.
That's a great mission to have. Thank you. And I said you were a special guest, I guess. I should explain. You were at the Innovate Finance Global Summit this week, and you were on stage, you and your team, so presenting really your synthetic data proposition, which I believe is called Heisel. And we're very excited about this because it will enable a lot more innovation and collaboration in the financial services sector. So I guess I wanted to start with a bit of a description as to what you call synthetic data. It's a term that not everyone will be aware of.
Yeah, it's a bit of a head scratcher, I guess. Synthetic data. Why do we need synthetic data when, you know, we hear so much about all the real data that there is, you know, continually being produced and stored and processed about us all and everything that we do. I guess the thing I would say is that synthetic data is artificial data about people, about you know, businesses or our events that doesn't contain any real world data inside of it, or tries not to contain any real world data inside of it. And why is that important? Well, with data comes huge kind of responsibilities and regulation around how you can store it, how you can process it, and how you can use it. You know, so whether that's from the permissions that the data subjects give you as a data processor to process that data, or indeed the laws of the land, like the GDPR and other kind of applicable laws, which tell you the ways in which you're permitted and not permitted to use that data. We all know that data is critical to innovation. I spent a number of years in a fintech, and that was one of the key reasons for our success, was we were able to access good quality data in open banking to produce some really great products and services around that. But I think particularly for the people listening to this podcast, how many great ideas have you had, or products that you wanted to build, but you just didn't have the data to do that? Either you didn't have access to the data or enough of it, or you had the data but you weren't allowed to process it or permitted to use it in a given way. And that's where synthetic data really comes in to produce really high quality data sets that contain many of the same properties as the real data, and then really allow people to accelerate innovation, to build new products, to get proofs of concept in front of the customer or the investors or whoever, and really sort of turbocharge that progress that you can make that access or permission to use data just now is stopping you from doing.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, it's data that's maybe a bit more GDPR compliant, allows you to test with removing the risk of maybe securities around data. Is it as good as real world data in terms of if I'm an entrepreneur and I've got an idea and I want to test it? If I use synthetic data, will it be as good as using real world data?
I think when I think about synthetic data and how good it is or its quality, I think about three things. One is the fidelity of the data. And so what I mean by that is how well the synthetic data I guess represents or how similar it is to real world data. So does it have the same I guess structure and correlations in there? So, you know, for instance, if we think about banking data, for example, then, you know, do we see that more affluent people spend more money on things like holidays or shopping, and then people that are less affluent maybe have to manage their budget differently, or they shop and manage their budget differently, or shop in different places, or something like that. The second thing that I think about the quality is the privacy or the risk around the data. So, if I use synthetic data, is there any risk of unintended disclosure of personal information of people whose data I might have used to construct the data set, or anything about the anything commercially sensitive that might be in there? And third, and I think this kind of like maybe speaks most directly to your question, is around the utility. How useful is the data to get the job done that I need to that I need to do, you know, whether that's to build a new product, whether that's to test if my technology works at scale, whether it's to put together a proof of concept for a customer or investor or something like that. And I think taking those three things together, there's certainly a trade-off in amongst all of that. You know, the more realistic or the more the higher the fidelity the data needs to be, then obviously there's an impact on you know, potentially the privacy risk of using data. Real world data has the highest fidelity, of course, but it also has the like you mentioned, Michael, the compliance and other regulatory complexity around privacy, around permissions, and so on. And so, what synthetic data really lets you do is use something which is almost kind of like as good as the real world data from the perspective of the fidelity, but with much higher utility because it's much more useful and much more accessible, and also takes away many of the complexities around the privacy and the compliance.
Fascinating. No, thank you. Thank you for that. And so, how do you go about creating synthetic data? What's the magic process?
So there's two main ways in which it's done. The first way is to use machine learning approaches. And so what happens is that you take you know, the real data that you might use. So you might, if you're a fintech, you might have access to open banking data, you might have access to payments data or some other data about the customer or the process that you want to use. You then you use machine learning and AI, which might be a neural network or nearest neighbors type of approach, which learns all the relationships and structures within the data. Then you kind of like flip the algorithm around. So once it's learned all those relationships and patterns, you use it not to learn about the data, but instead to generate data which complies or follows those rules and patterns which you've just learned. You probably want to add a little bit of noise to the data as well to preserve any kind of the privacy in the data that you are using. So, for example, you might be quite careful where the data points are very very sparse, you know, so for real outliers in the data, you know, whether that's geographically or in terms of the specific characteristics of the people or the data subjects in the source data, so that you don't want to create a copy or something that's very close to this very rare occurrence in the data that could only really be traced back to one person. And then once you've done all that, you execute the generation process, and that will then output a data set which captures as much as you can about the original data set's relationships and correlations, but with the privacy and with the randomness of the generation process, then none of the data points look too similar to any specific individual or organization that you're trying to model, so that you maintain as much of the privacy as you can. So that's the first way, the kind of the AI machine learning approach. The second way, and the way that we at Smart Data Foundry have been spend most of our time, is to use agent-based simulation. So we create synthetic individuals, synthetic companies, and synthetic scenarios from scratch with software that we've built. So no real data is ever used in the generation process. And we create, you know, rules and behaviors that these organizations and individuals can follow. And then we execute simulations for, you know, the amount of time that we need. So for instance, again, in like an open banking or a fraud use case, we might run the simulation for 2 years. The synthetic people, the synthetic agents in the simulation will live their simulated lives for that amount of time. So they'll be paid salaries, they will go shopping, they'll go on holiday, they'll sign up or cancel subscriptions to services, pay their bills, all of those kind of like normal behaviors that they might do. The companies will pay salaries, will buy and sell goods and services to each other, that kind of thing as well. And then we log all of the events that happen during that simulation, and then we can convert that into formatted data or formatted synthetic data, which then can be used. So that's the two, I guess, main approaches. They have pros and cons. The AI machine learning based methods are probably the highest potential fidelity, but the two drawbacks. One is that you need the real data first of all to be able to create the synthetic version of the data, and so if you don't have real data to begin with, then you can't really use the machine learning methods to create a synthetic version of it. The other main drawback that it has is that you need to be very, very careful and manage carefully the privacy of all the people and the other data subjects that are in that data set, even after you've created the synthetic double, because you might inadvertently create some data that's very, very close to the original, which could be reverse engineered or traced back somehow to the original data subject, which then obviously opens up all kinds of sort of risks for you as an organization. On the other hand, the agent-based simulations completely eliminate the privacy risk by not using real data in the first place. However, the trade-off there is that the potential fidelity is probably a little bit lower than on the AI machine learning-based methods, simply because of the methods that's used. However, the privacy is so much better, and the utility can be much higher as a result, because you are able to use the data in more freely than you can with the other methods, and you might be more comfortable sharing data sets that are created through agent-based simulation, collaboration, you know, both inside or between your own and other organizations and so on, where you probably want to be a little bit more careful or a little bit more sensitive about how you use synthetic data that's created directly from real data.
And is it the agent-based simulation model that you've used when you've done some work for the financial regulator recently around the APP fraud?
Yes, it was. So we worked with the FCA and the PSR towards the tail end of 2022 on what they called a tech sprint. Think of a kind of like a 3-day hackathon is probably one way to imagine it, where they invited lots and lots of people to come together to try and innovate in the area of the authorized push payment fraud. A little bit of context on that for those that might not know. It's the biggest growing, fastest growing rather, financial crime in the UK over the last couple of years. In 2022, or the numbers that were published in 2022, the consumers alone reported more than £500 million in losses to push payment fraud. I think if you then also include businesses in that, then that increases by another third or so. So it's getting on for £1 billion in losses, and that's just what's reported. This type of fin crime is particularly kind of insidious. It's a kind of like based on deception and social engineering. We've probably all been at least aware of it. I certainly have been getting more than a few text messages claiming to be from delivery companies, say that I've missed and they want me to send £10, £15, whatever, to come back and redeliver. And that's just one example of the push payment fraud. You know, it's someone who is impersonating an organisation that I might think I have a relationship with and then asking me to send them some money. That's just the tip of the iceberg, though. There's many different ways that the push payments frauds manifest. From those kind of like advanced fees, you know, some missed deliveries or service charges, to other more complex impersonation, where someone might phone you up pretending to be from the fraud department at your bank or from the tax office, you know, doing very, very convincing jobs of that impersonation and trying to persuade people, particularly vulnerable people, to part with huge sums of money. You also see other types of manifestation of it, you know, fake goods that are available on online marketplaces and so on, and or maybe people impersonating members of your family via text message and asking for financial help for some kind of emergency. So bringing it back to your actual question about how we actually generated the data for that. So I think one of the reasons I kind of talked through how all these frauds work is to show that actually these are, it's a very, very complex data structure. If you wanted to analyze this type of problem, you've got data that you might need to get from banking systems, you know, so transactions, excuse me, when they happened, who they were between, etc. You might want to also look at telecommunications data. So, for instance, people that, you know, getting information about who was texting or phoning each other, and how those data sets might then relate. You know, did someone get contacted by a number that they've never seen before, end up in a hour-long conversation and then transfer them £100,000 at the end of it? That kind of thing can could be a signal of some kind of impersonation, push payment fraud that was happening. Coupled with that you might want to include also some criminal data around, you know, the outcomes of the scam reports, and you know, which ones were successful, which ones were not successful. And you've got a very, very complex data environment. And so if I think about what issues that might present when you're looking to innovate in that area, then you've got you know, data that's coming from multi-sectors, from banking and telecoms. So you might have regulations that would be in play from the FCA around the banking data, from the ICO, from the data about the individuals that were involved, regulations from the PSR around the payments and how they were executed, and then also from Ofcom, who would have an interest, obviously, in the telecommunications data that you might want to bring together. And so thinking about the complexity of the data, just from a technical point of view, and then also from a privacy and sensitivity point of view, this is an example use case where synthetic data really shines and comes into its own. If I was to think about getting all of that data together for real for any kind of volume of people, then I think that would be a career's work. You know, it would be 10 years before you
could actually.
Yeah, you would need to change and overcome so many barriers that, you know, it would take a very long time. Let's just put it that way to get there, even if you ever could. So synthetic data is clearly, you know, only viable way to get people together from all kinds of different backgrounds, from different organizations, to come together and to innovate, which was the goal that the FCA and the PSR had for their tech sprint. So why would you want people from all different organizations? Well, if you come from banking, you'll always have a view and a perspective, but it'll be a banking view. If you come from telecoms, the same, but it'll be a telecommunications-centric view. If you come from a charity, or you come from law enforcement, or you come from, you know, consumer advocacy, you'll bring your own perspective, but you also have your own kind of, I guess, tunnel vision, which comes from just your history and all the work that you've done there. And so bringing together participants from as many different backgrounds as possible can only really help, I guess, you know, with that broadening the scope of any solutions that might be built. But you know, we have all the complexity of the data that comes with it. You know, for the same reasons that bringing the real data together, synthetic doubles, the AI ML approach, just simply couldn't work either, because you not only would you have to get all the real data together in the first place, uh-huh. You'd have to synthesize it, which would be quite complex across such a, you know, sort of complicated data landscape as well. So agent-based simulation was the approach that we took. We worked together with you know, experts in the field to get a little bit of their perspective on how the data might look, how it might be used by people in the tech sprint. There's lots of really great resources out there, public domain data around how these scams and frauds come into being. And so what we were able to do was to take our ISIL platform with the synthetic data generation capabilities already had around banking, around identity and so on, and really augment that with thinking about, you know, the context of how these scams manifest. So, you know, so we created social networks within our data, people who knew each other and then people that they didn't know, family members, you know, work colleagues, etc., friends, and then what we were able to do was build, I suppose, the financial and the communication structure that you would see kind of like normally just organically grow from these kind of networks of people that know each other. To really kind of like generate the, let's just say, the business as usual, the ideal world with no crime in it. And then we created synthetic criminals in the data as well. And they might have taken the form of individuals or of, you know, companies that were set up for a specific purpose to take the money or facilitate the scam, and had them then try to interact with the world that we built, tempt people into you know, trying to find victims on for these scams, and then executing them, and then we simulated that over a couple of years, recorded all the successes, all the failures, and then generated this very, very detailed data set, which then allowed all the TechSprint participants to work on for 3 days.
How long did that take you to simulate those 2 or 3 years of data?
So we started working on the data in kind of like late summer, and it probably took us 6-8 weeks to build all of new functionality and the different types of behaviors that we needed for the sprint. Once all that was done, to actually generate the final data sets that went, it was an afternoon, really. You know, we created 100,000 synthetic people who worked with or who transacted with four synthetic banks and also two synthetic telecommunications companies, served all the communications between them. And so we generated 2 years of call and transaction history, banking came out of that as well, and also the fraudulent interactions. The output of all of that was around about 500 million rows of data, which totaled about 200 gigabytes, which was massive. But yeah, that took us about an afternoon to generate. It took us about the same amount of time to transfer as well. As you can imagine, it's quite a big data set. In the end, we actually cut it down a little bit for the tech sprint, just to make it a bit more easy to handle for the participants. We didn't want to add the engineering to the complexities of the tech sprint. So we cut it down to 20,000 customers, and everything else kind of fell in line with that. But yeah, it's we've built a We've built a platform that can generate data very, very quickly, and I think what this example shows as well is that we, whilst we have the standard data sets and packages that we produce around open banking, around identity, around fraud now and so on, we're also really keen to work with organisations that have, you know, interest in maybe kind of like special requirements about that, and figure out a way where we can work together to create synthetic data sets for specific jobs that need to get done.
Fantastic. And what's the future of IDO? I'm thinking about the news around AI at the minute. And do you see yourself moving into the kind of generative AI in terms of content, where instead of just seeing the connections through your model, you can also have the actual content generated about the scam itself?
Yeah, I've played with ChatGPT and some of the other large language models a little bit, just to kind of, you know, see what it can do, what it can add, what interesting capabilities it has. I think you know, the potential, we're only just seeing the very start of it. I mean, it's only it feels like a lot longer, but it's only been a few months since ChatGPT really kind of like hit the public kind of domain. And it's obviously generated a lot of hype, and everyone's very, very excited about the potential. I think that it's inevitable that at some point we need to think about how these technologies interact and what they can do together, because I'm convinced, yeah, that it will be extraordinarily transformational for all of us working in technology, what these models can do. For me, I guess what I'm excited by and what I'm really looking forward to doing is working with, you know, thinking about my own kind of sort of background working in kind of, you know, open banking, fintech and so on, is working with organizations that are just starting out and looking to, or looking to scale up, that have real kind of issues around data availability or permission to use it, and helping. I think what I'll be really excited by is how can we help small organizations take those first steps to scaling up and building brilliant products based as much as possible on synthetic data, right? I think that's going to be a real game changer for the fintech community when we start to see synthetic data driving these brilliant new kind of propositions and ideas that all the entrepreneurs out there are going to come up with. We're already working with a number of fintechs. You know, I'm working with one particular one who's looking to break into and disrupt the credit reference market, and we've been helping them with synthetic identity data so that they can build their own kind of like algorithms for matching individuals at the back end of the processes they make. And that's something that, you know, getting access to identity data obviously is very, very difficult, and we've been able to provide them with millions of rows of data on synthetic individuals that then they can go and prove that their algorithms work. And that's what's truly exciting for me, is how synthetic data really can make a difference and help sort of startups and scale-ups really really achieve their potential.
Well, that's music to my ear, really, at FinTech Scotland. This is fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing all of this with us today. A real pleasure to have you, and I certainly learned a lot. So thank you, David.
Thank you, Michael. It's been great to talk to you.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us today, and we'll speak to you again very soon. Don't forget to subscribe. Bye-bye.